CBS Island World. I'm John Batchelor. Lucy. Lucy is the name, the pet name of a NASA robot outbound for an important mission with asteroids. However, I welcome Bob Zimmerman. He keeps the website Behind the Black. He's here to update us because there's difficulties, anomaly is the official word, of Lucy's solar array. And Bob's going to update us on the patch, the fix, the road ahead. Bob, a very good evening to you.
Well, Lucy, just to review, is going to one of the Trojan asteroid clusters that orbits either fore or aft 60 degrees of Jupiter. It's going to visit at least 8 satellite asteroids when it's there. It was launched about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, and it has these two fan-like solar arrays, like a Chinese fan, opening up into a circle. One opened and completed and latched. The other one did not. And they've been assessing the situation to figure out what they were going to do. They had announced they're going to try to do a fix in April. They now have revealed some more details. The array itself has, and I've got a picture on Behind the Black that shows at least what this is, so you'll understand what I'm talking about. The array that did not latch has opened about 347 degrees. At that configuration, it's providing the spacecraft about 90% of the expected power. So they say the power is not an issue, and that they could do the mission entirely with the amount of power that they're getting. So assuming nothing changes, Lucy's in good shape. However, the panel has not latched. So once again, think of a Chinese fan that you unfurl into a circle and you don't latch it. The tension of the pleats is going to want to try to maybe bring it back closed. And so when they get out into farther distances near Jupiter, they need all the power they can get in as much solar array area as possible. And this won't be locked. And so they're reviewing it. They've now revealed that a lanyard might have gotten somewhat tangled, and they think they can use the motor on the array to pull that lanyard and thus pull the array into a latched position. They're not in a rush. They're still aiming for April to try that, assuming they'll do it. They might decide not to do anything at all, because if they do something and it messes up something else, that's no good. But if they do that, it carries the risk that the panel will start to close later on, and that could be other problems. So this is where we stand.
To the planet Pluto, I emphasize, the planet Pluto. The debate's back, Bob. What's happened? How? I thought we settled this.
No, it was never settled. The original International Astronomical Union decision made at the late night hours of a Sunday end of conference when most people had left, and it was held in Czechoslovakia, so there was only a handful of people left, they voted for this really absurd definition of what a planet is. And from day one, every planetary scientist that I spoke to, many off the record, most on the record, told me that this was an absurd definition and they don't use it. That's planetary scientists, the people who do research on planets. They said it's an absurd definition. Pluto is a planet. And they would tell me how a lot of the moons of the solar system are planets, including our own moon. Because the way they look at planets is, and by the way, the news here is that planetary scientists, a whole group of eminent planetary scientists, have just published a peer review paper documenting how moons and asteroids were routinely referred to as planets from Galileo until 2006, when this stupid definition was come up with. And the reason they were defined as planets is because planetary scientists explain, if an object in space is large enough to become spherical, like a planet, it's a planet. It's got complicated, it'll have complicated geology, it'll have complicated possibly meteorology, and therefore it needs to be treated like a planet. And so they published this new paper, and it's part of, I think, what seems to be a new campaign by the planetary scientists to get people to rethink this dumb definition. And I've never called it anything but dumb. It's very inconsistent, unclear, and not very helpful a definition. And so that planetary scientist wants to go back to a basic definition, which would say anything spherical is a planet. It means we won't have 9 planets in our solar system. We'll have many hundreds. But so what? We'll at least have a clear definition of what a planet is. A good proof of this, John, is how we routinely call any planet, anything discovered circling a star, in another planet, an exoplanet, a planet.
Right.
We just assume it's a planet.
Right.
And so that's where we're going.
Mars, water, but this time it's not Bugs and Elmer. It's about Mars and how long ago water may have existed on the surface of Mars. This is Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Bob, I'm looking at a very fancy presentation on your page. What am I looking at?
Okay, well, I put up figure 2 from the published paper this week. And that figure shows a variety of maps, global maps of Mars, where they note where they have discovered clusters or spots where there is basically salt deposits. And the salt deposits appear to be mostly in depressions or craters. And what they say, and the scientists say from this, is what they think these salt deposits are telling them, is that we're looking at the leftover salt when liquid water evaporated away. You know, you get this normally on Earth, you know, like salt flats. If there's salt in the water and the water evaporates, the salt remains on the surface. What is interesting about this particular study is that doing crater counts in the area where these salt deposits are, and they're all across the planet in the crater southern highlands, the crater counts suggest that some of them could have evaporated, the liquid could have evaporated as recently as 2.3 billion years ago, which is 700 million years more recent than had previously been theorized for the liquid water. Now, there's a lot of unknowns here. The scientists make one point that's very important. There's small amounts of water that would have caused these deposits. They're mostly in puddles or ponds or perched depressions. There's not a lot of water involved. They say it was most likely from the occasional melting of ice. Think about a layer of ice or a glacier at the base. You could have melting, and that might be where this water is. And then as the glacier goes away, then the last bits of water evaporate away as well. So not necessarily running water, though that's a possibility. And that's the unknown here, John. It's still Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd arguing back and forth because the unknowns are many.
Yes, yes. All right, off to the moon. An unmanned lunar lander for a launch from Russia, Roscosmos at it. Now, Bob, lunar landers, I think, are logical, and China's got one, and now Russia's going to have one. We don't have a lunar lander at this point, do we? We don't have a rover on the surface of the moon.
No, we don't. But you know, so Russia's planning to launch. This is what the story is. Russia has now scheduled July 23rd as its target date for launching the first Russian unmanned lunar lander since the 1970s, basically since the Soviet era. And it's been delayed. This is Luna 25, they call it. They're picking up the numbers from the Soviet era. And it's been delayed numerous times. It should have launched a few years ago, but it's been delayed. And yes, China's got one, and Russia's now hoping to have one before the end of the year, but that doesn't mean the U.S. is trailing badly. We have about a dozen, somewhere between eight and a dozen, I keep losing count, private commercial lunar landers or rovers in the pipeline.
Okay.
And several, one should have launched already if Blue Origin's BE-4 engine wasn't delayed and the Vulcan rocket from ULA could have launched when wanted. That would have been an American lunar rover already on the moon. Could have been. But either way, we got a dozen in pipe. But now the Russians hopefully will get their first lunar land. It's going to land in the southern polar region's high latitude, but still about 250 miles away from the South Pole and not particularly close to anywhere the permanent shadow craters are.
Bob is the author of Universe in a Mirror, the biography of Hubble, the superly successful NASA robot. The robot had troubles once. It needed bifocals, and there was a patch, there was a fix, and there's a moment where the fix worked. When was it, Bob?
This was in 1993. I talk about this extensively in Universe in a Mirror. It's a great story. And the image that really proved Hubble had been fixed was an image of the massive star Eta Carinae. And that picture showed undeniably the first sharp and unambiguous view of a massive star exploding. And so now Hubble, over the decades now, since 1993, has been taking repeated pictures of Eta Carinae to track how that explosive the lobes of explosive material expanding out from the star, how it's evolving. And they published this week a great short video outlining what's been learned over all these 30-some-odd years. And I posted it on Behind the Black. It's really cool because it really, they give you three-dimensional views rotating so you can really see what the lobes look like. And this is, and they also show you early and later pictures of the lobes by Hubble to show how it's expanded over the time. It's still exploding outward. And this is all from an explosion that occurred in the middle 1800s that made this star the brightest in the sky for a very short time. It's going to go supernova in a couple of million years, John. So keep your eyes open.
Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Beyond the Black. We're going space engineering next. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.